Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
McCabe is one of the great writers, living or dead. He's from Clonus, which is among the northwest black slanting hills of County Monaghan. And his new novel is Golden Grove. And I think you have to read it with the Queen's English accent in your head, which is a bit of a departure. Pat McCabe, delighted to have you in studio.
Good man, Oliver. Good to be here.
Are you in good form?
Yeah. As far as you'd be expected from brooding old writers, you know. Yeah, not bad.
What's your brooding level at the minute?
I'd say on a scale of 0 to 10, maybe around 4, which is pretty good.
That's not so bad at all. Yeah. What, in honour of God, are you doing inside the head of an MI5 agent in post-Brexit England, first of all, and he's thinking about 60s Dublin collusion in the north and all of that?
Well, it's, without skimping on the question, it's a kind of a surprise to me as well, you know. Although I hope it's a book that people will read, because while it's a departure, it's not entirely. But I suppose when you get to my age, you do tend to kind of survey your experience from the alpine slopes of maturity and peaks of maturity and that. And there's something about the forensic nature of the British mind and the analytic kind of aspect with the way that a British people or men, particularly of the 50s, of a certain class would view human behaviour. Remember, I don't know what age I was, but someone was talking about something particularly Irish or Gaelic, and said, "'Twas like the salmon, you know, the salmon of knowledge, when the salmon would dream." And the English chap said, "Dear fellow, fish don't dream."
And anti-poetic.
Well, you know, the legal mind, you know, that works particularly well for that kind of person of that class. And if, I suppose if you have been in a position of domination, you know, the educated classes, it suits that particular kind of order. And this is me being kind of objective about the objective, as it were. So when I found myself writing about things like, shall we say, the partition of Ireland, the giving back of the ports, which is kind of the source of a lot of the troubles and misunderstandings that pertain to this very day. You know, why did Chamberlain give the ports back? Why did Malcolm MacDonald condone it? How did De Valera outmaneuver the British, being even more forensic than they were?
Dismantling bits of the treaty over...
All that, you see, which is why I kind of spend a little bit of time reading about De Valera, because he seemed to me to be better than the British at that forensic kind of mathematical reasoning and frustrated them over the conference table. You know, I think Churchill said at one point, no, it was Lloyd George, actually, he said... God, it's an infernal fellow to deal with. They said, we've been here for 2 days and we've only got as far as Cromwell. And I think people who would be of the Collins kind of cast of mind misunderstood his strategy, in that it's very attractive to look back at people like Collins, who are full of passion and full of emotion. But that doesn't work in terms of the legal forensic mind. They just expect it and they know how to deal with it. What De Valera was doing was playing them at their own game. Now, that's a long roundabout way of saying, why did I choose the voice, this sort of excavating archaeologist looking at the Irish mind from the elevated kind of position of almost like, as one reviewer said to me already, like a David Attenborough figure turning over the Irish rocks to see what he would find. And the more I... adopted that tone, the more the material began to reveal itself to me.
His name, is it Chenevics or
Chenevics Meredith?
Meredith. Mm. So you know straight away this is the kind of...
Anglo-Norman kind of.
Yeah, and we see Ireland through his eyes the whole time. It's not a flattering view most of the time.
I think that it's true to what a person of that cast would be like. Now, you have to remember there's a lot of duplicity going on within the book itself, because when you're dealing with the machinations of, you know, special services, you never know if what you're getting is the truth. Now, the narrator in this book constantly refers to another character who may be an alter ego. So at the end of the book, you think, ah, now we see clearly what was going on. Then it suddenly dawns on you. It's like what Hitchcock called the icebox moment, you know. And you're leaning down to get the lettuce. Think, well, wait a minute, that's not what it was at all. And the whole thing, what intelligence terms is often called the slow waltz, you know, which that really means is if there's been some horrible atrocity, as there have been many in the north of Ireland, what happens is the families are frustrated over years and years and years. It's this long, slow waltz, a dance of death until everybody concerned is dead and the system continues.
You have to get right to the end to find out what's going on here.
Well, so it should be, shouldn't it? It's like, it is a thriller to some extent.
If I start by asking what's Golden Grove, sure, you would never give the answer because...
Well, you could say that it's a poem by Gerard Manley Hopkins because then anyone who's shelling out their few quid will say, well, we're getting a little bit of poetry and lyricism as well as
right,
a thriller.
You do, yeah.
That's my story anyway.
A short poem by Gerard Manley.
Yeah. It's Golden Grove by Gerard Manley Hopkins.
Which is kind of, it's like Rosebud in Citizen Kane.
Very much so, yeah.
You obviously love your film because it's dotted the whole way through. Yes. Does he hate Ireland, this character?
No. I think the whole point of trying to inhabit this forensic mind is hate is not their business. Mm. You know, any more than...
It's too emotional.
Of course.
Yeah.
Hate is not in it. And I think maybe that's a misunderstanding that subject nations often fall prey to. They forget that the more emotion they expend, the more they're losing.
What's fun in the satire is because we're just looking at things we know well through this fella's eyes, including a really funny imagined episode of The Late Late Show. I think it's imagined. It could well have happened.
It's close enough.
I was afraid to look it up.
Yeah, so was I. I was afraid to come in here today because I wait a second. There's a couple of characters there that most Irish people of my generation certainly will recognise.
And I think this character liked Gay Byrne.
Yeah.
Very much so.
Well, I think in my case, it's an infection portrait of that period because, you know, I came of age, I suppose, before the North blew up, really, when people retrospectively look at Ireland and, you know, as if, it, you know, again, we get this constant recurrent cliche, you know, the Dark Ages. Well, you know, that's a very convenient kind of label. In fact, if you look at, you know, the magazines of the period, say around 65, 69, you get this sense of a whole cultural thing being kind of an indigenous, partly Irish, partly English, but, you know, a confidence that's building culturally, which you now see the seeds of what you now see with the traditional boom and all the rest of it, and the comedians especially, like, they were all beginning to happen then, you know, and... Yeah. The colourful characters that's often, you know, claimed as a cliche but life, because of it was community based, everyone knowing there's a good side to that as well as a bad one, you know, that it used to be, oh, the main streets of this or that town, the further you go, the meaner it gets. But the thing about small towns and, you know, even smallish cities and all, to have a place where your name is known, it's an identity thing it's a very nice thing to carry with you through your life. And now that it doesn't really obtain as much, you know, other writers will write about that, the absence of it, or does it make any difference? But for me, the kind of texture of that life that I've kind of documented in The Golden Grove, which would be The Late Late Show, Parkinson, the cine-literate generation, you know, they... Shadow cinema of the 70s can come into it with the youth as much as, you know, the Dave Allen kind of world, you know, which was, everybody forgets that too, you know, while there's a very clerical orient, there was also a lot of anti-clericalism in Ireland.
There was. Was kind of mainstream in ways that we don't credit it with today, do we?
I think it should be looked at again, some of that.
Even when you watch the films of that era, you expect America to be the conservative movement, but in actual fact, they're much more daring than they are even now.
Yeah, that's so true. Well, we took a lot of these things for granted. Like, dotted throughout the Golden Grove book is an aspect of culture that was very influential as far as which we call maybe the shadow cinema of the 70s, you know, movies that perhaps never really attained Oscar fame or anything like that, but they would have serious existential kind of anti-Vietnam kind of politics threaded throughout. You know, cowboy movies like Ulzana's Raid, for example, by Robert Aldrich, you know, and then, you know, continental movies that came and went, you know, just almost by accident. There was never any kind of big hoo-ha about them. But the idea that we didn't have access to this stuff simply because of the laws is a misapprehension.
We wouldn't have had the writers that the era produced either, sure, if they hadn't seen any of this.
Oh, I think you'll always have writers in Ireland. I don't think there's going to be any way you're going to stop that.
A pub, of course, central location, the Scotch House Pub.
Yeah.
Twice turned into an office block, I think, since its demise.
I don't know when it disappeared. It was a thriving place when I was a student in the 70s, and it was a lot full of newspaper men. I still see the remnants of it now. But I used it because of its location on Bord Quay. So you had right in the heart of the city. And
round the corner from Mulligan's.
Mulligan's as well, yeah. So again, I suppose I like to use these locations because they're so recognisable. But the forensic kind of English view of it enables me to be unsentimental about it.
Right, yeah.
You know, because it'd be very easy because you have such good times in these places and they were so called to fall prey to the rare old times kind of.
Yes. And they meet the publican whose name is Paddy Murphy on the first day. And
well, do you know, I think he talks like that.
Okay.
He'd be good at this now. But the Englishman says to him, do you go to the plays at all, Paddy? Paddy Murphy. Come over here, Paddy. And so he's, you know, conveniently named Paddy Murphy. And he says to him, tell me, Paddy, do you go to the plays at all? Do you? I hear a lot of the Irish are very interested in the drama. Ah, no, sir, that wouldn't be for me at all, sir. Oh, you don't go to see perhaps, you know, the latest Hugh Leonard play or the latest Brian? Ah, no, sir. No, I don't. Myself and the wife, we'd be more inclined for the owl ones, you know. It wouldn't be pegging me heart for me. It'd be more the owl ones, do you know? And the Englishman says, and what would the owl ones be, Pat? Maybe like Oedipus Rex or Antigone, maybe, or Agamemnon, or do you know what the wife loves, sir? Sir, she loves a long day's journey into night. And he walks away. So you think, who's playing who?
Yeah, yeah, who's undermining? Because he's looking out into the Liffey quite a lot, isn't he, this publican?
So he's listening to everything. So you think these guys are, you know, British agents. And there's an awful lot of the Irish people who they're watching, spending a lot of time watching what's going on outside the window. So the idea of a lot of the plotline is, are the watchers being watched, which is, you know, and, you know, the subject of their attentions is not without resources either.
It's very Le Carré at times.
Mm.
Did you mean to do that?
I did, yeah. I wouldn't have anything like Jean Le Carré's plot skills or anything, but I read all his letters and I know a lot of his books. So I sort of swam on that water for a while and used what was of use to me, really. You know, but I was more concerned with the, I suppose, transmogrifying the experience that I had had, really, because the North, I was at St. McCartan's College in Monaghan when Bloody Sunday happened. So you're 17 years of age and this is the world you're walking out into. And up until then, the world that I've been describing, the sort of cultural, colourful world of the opening up Late Late Show, it was quite exciting. All the English progressive rock bands were making a noise and you walked out into hell, basically. And you thought, now we have to, although I wasn't experiencing anything like the people across the border, although I had spent some time in Belfast, and I thought, this is just awful. And, you know, it affected the development of what was, you know, always, you know, derisively called the Free State at that time. It's a common phrase along the border. It was at that time.
Yeah.
Are you from the state, you know, or the wee six and all that stuff. But it wasn't a joke at all, you know. So that's where the ports and all the rest of it comes in. Now history has come home to roost again. And if you're 17, that's not the world you want, but there's no way you can avoid it. You don't have the luxury of saying, actually, that old thing's all over now.
Right.
Well, it wasn't then. Yeah.
It simmers away.
I'm afraid so.
You went to London at 17, didn't you?
Well, just the same way as everybody did, Oliver. It wasn't like, well, I suppose I did go over thinking I was going to walk into some kind of theatre in the West End and say, hi, guys, I'm here. You know, what do you got?
Did you sense the view that certain class of English had towards the Irish then?
But I also sensed the view that they had the same view towards north of England and the same towards Wales and the same towards Scottish. So I suppose you had to do your crash course in history to realise, you know, and also very important to realise when you're dealing with that, like, there's no point in getting emotional about it. They don't see it that way. They never did. And all that's changed now anyway. But at that time was, you were still living with the burden of De Valera again not being in the war. Shirkers. You know, it wasn't that long before that.
Of course,
it was only 25, 30 years. So in the back of the taxi, Irish, are you?
Yeah.
North or south? The distinction used to always be made, which really intrigued me, you know. So if you said south, went there, were you? Nah, me old buddies, yeah.
It's kind of the same, similar conversation at the moment that we're not paying for our own security and we're freeloading off NATO and then...
Ah, get over it, you guys.
You turned 70, I believe, recently. 70, looking back at 17, do you have a perspective? Do you...
Have I got any nuggets of wisdom to share with the young broadcaster? Absolutely not. Keep reading Viz comic. That's the only thing that makes any sense to me at this age. Yeah.
Thank God the comics are still around.
Oh, they are, yeah. Yeah.
The novel, because it's clearly about memory, isn't it? Because
yeah.
This guy is looking back at memory. And Pogue Mahone was about memory in terms of Alzheimer's. And yeah. it was in the family, wasn't it? And it affected yourself and Margot, your artist wife.
Yes.
Very significantly. It is sort of in this novel as well, isn't it?
Well, it's a thing that has affected so many families, you know, the as we grow older, remain older, and having experienced it close hand, I suppose it always seeps into your writing, that kind of, what is the nature of memory? Are we all just an agglomeration of things that happened to us? And if you take those away, what do you become? And it leads you to notions of the immortal soul, doesn't it? I mean... Now that, you know, I mean, that, all these things are back in the air, you know, with the Pope, and you see the extraordinary kind of gathering. People are concerned about these things now in Gaza, you know. What are we?
Yeah.
What are we? Are we just consumers? And you get someone close to you like that who doesn't remember your name. Man, you know.
This was your father-in-law.
Yeah.
And you were very close.
Yeah.
What's that like? Is it frightening?
I think it must lead you to prayer, actually, because it's although I'm not particularly religious, but I can understand how people would go on their knees and say, can you help me with this?
You must be religious if you pray.
Nah, I'd like to be, but I'm not.
It doesn't work for you?
Ah, well, it does after a fashion, but I suppose I'm what would be described as a collapsed Catholic.
There's a bit of it still knocking around, it sounds like.
I hope so.
Do you think about it yourself, the existence and... the future?
Well, as the fellow says, you wouldn't be much of a writer if you didn't, would you? Because, I mean, why do you do it anyway, sit in a room making up all these stories about people that don't exist? It's some kind of form of, and then Joyce said, you know, you lower the pail into the well of the subconscious and see what it brings up, you know. So obviously you have to lower the pail into the well of your memory and the memories of all those close to you. Mm. So I think, particularly in Ireland, with small towns, the family, you're not only telling your own story, but you're telling the story of your town, your county, your country, your identity, all that stuff.
That's why this one is different, I suppose, isn't it? Because you've stepped...
Well, it isn't really. I mean, it probably... But the preoccupations are the same. But I suppose to get back to that forensic thing, that suits the age I'm at, to be able to, say, writing something like The Butcher Boy, which was a book about an emotional boy, but also very emotional about the society, because... it would have been recollecting that period of the 60s, you know, when you're not formed yet. You don't know what the world is. It's a magical, wondrous, overwhelming world. But hopefully at the age of 70, you've attained some measure of objectivity and you're able to kind of forensically examine what it is that you...
You were 37 when The Butcher Boy came out or when you wrote it.
Mm.
That must seem extraordinary to you now, looking back at that.
In what way, Oliver?
Well, you were 37, like you're saying, you're 70. Did you know enough about the world to...
Well, I knew enough about childhood, you know, which is what it was about. And so there's a kind of a searing emotional honesty, almost to the point of kind of collapse, really, that is almost your skin is peeled off this character.
Hmm.
But he hasn't maybe got the noose of the wherewithal to withstand the slings and arrows. But at the age of 70, and the character in this book has, and he's got all sorts of skills and evasions and tricks to endure, I suppose.
He doesn't know what it's all for still, but it doesn't really matter, does it, to that mind?
I don't think it does. He's being tasked with a particular job and he's going to see it through.
Whereas Francie Brady, he's deranged, but he's thinking about those big questions, isn't he, of the end of the world.
Well, children are capable of, you know, great vulnerability and, you know, his relationship, again, with saints and with the Blessed Virgin Mary, that's an existential dialogue going on at the age of 10 or 11, you know. And I think anybody reared in the Catholic tradition would have always had that kind of period of almost ecstatic, you know, every boy wanted to be a priest, every girl wanted to be a nun at some point or some version of it. And it's a very valuable kind of inheritance, I think.
Because we're chatting about that kind of British psyche and its attitude towards us over here, beyond. You're a granddad now, and I believe one of your grandchildren has a lovely London accent.
She has the London Irish accent, although there is a kind of a little touch of it appearing, but I'm told not to speak about that because she doesn't like me asking her to sing There Was an Old Man Called Michael Finnegan. So that's banned, I'm afraid, but I get a great kick out of it. I do, because it's a particular accent, you see. And it's the first time I've had it in my family. Like, we've got other grandchildren, but they're...
This is a whole new excitement.
Well, how would it not be? You know?
I'm sure Leitrim brings a bit of it as well. That's
almost certainly does, yeah. But they, you know, they're 10 and I've 6 now, and they're well. But this is another kind of kid on the block that's kind of different, which is... it's a real privilege having grandchildren, you know, it really is.
It's a privilege because I suppose you grew up in an era where 70 was ancient.
Oh, yeah.
Now it's fine.
We forget that. I mean, I never knew my grandparents. Most people were dead by 60, 65. And, well, it has its problems as well. But I suppose you became a man at 14 in those years as well. So it's changed. But, I mean, for all the troubles in the world, and God knows there are enough, we almost live like Roman emperors now, you know, like with hot water and central heating and health, two cars. I mean...
You don't want to think about it too often, but we probably should.
Well, it kind of helps me anyway.
Listen, I want to talk about other things, but unfortunately we have to take a bloody break.
Okay.
And but Golden Grove is out now with Unbound, which is the kind of crowd-funded anti-the man way of publishing a book. It's great crack.
Yeah.
Well done. You still have it.
It's
even in the age of what used to be dotage, but no longer.
Yeah.
Pat McCabe, I hope you enjoyed yourself somewhat. Bring you some of the messages for Pat McCabe. Great to hear a fellow Clonus man who's an innate power for the manipulation of word, phrase and rhythm towards a sizable and comprehensible end. A literary genius who does not receive the global recognition he deserves. Keep her lit, Pat, says Fintan. Well, twice on the Booker list, not bad. I used to work on Tara Street, our local pub's Mulligan's, an educational high for a young lad from County Down in the late 80s. We would work until late pints in Mulligan's. Great days, says Paul. I think that's an education that a lot of kids are missing nowadays. I'm delighted to hear Pat McCabe, who's brought me such entertainment throughout my life. The dramatisation of The Butcher Boy was one of the best theatre experiences ever. I loved everything he did and I'm looking forward to reading this book, says Mary. Well, Mary, run out now, Golden Grove. It's in the tricolours, colour and everything, published by Unbound. When I was in Trinity College, says another person, I wrote all my essays in the Scotch House. Really, I have very fond memories of the barman. Well, this is going to be right up your street, Joan, for sure. Great interview. He's fantastic. When in England, I'm asked, are you north or south? I always say Midlands. And it puts them in a spin. I want to tell you, Pat McCabe is at UCC in Howl on the 22nd of June. That's part of the Cork Midsummer Festival. And it's involving a fever dream in which Patrick Kavanagh flirts with psychedelia, is it, Pat? Communes with John Lennon and ponders notions of town and place. Also writer in residence at the Garage Theatre in Monaghan. So we look forward to some more new plays coming out of your head there.